Reagan was talking about. Reagan caught the boy's pause.
You did do the equations, didn't you? He asked.
What's an equation? Arlen asked.
That line, he pointed to the nearest ward, goes to that ward there.
He pointed to the wall.
It crosses these lines, he pointed to other wards, which crisscross with those here.
He pointed to still others.
It's as simple as that.
Reagan was aghast.
You mean you just eyeballed it? He demanded.
Arlen shrugged as Reagan turned back to him.
Most people use a straight stick to check the lines, he admitted, but I never bother.
How Tibbetts Brook isn't swallowed by the night, I have no idea, Reagan said. He pulled a sack from his saddlebag and knelt at the cave mouth, sweeping Arlen's wards away.
Dirt wards are still foolhardy, however well drawn, he said.
Reagan selected a handful of lacquered wooden ward plates from the sack. Using a straight stick marked with lines, he spaced them out quickly, resealing the net. It hadn't been dark for more than an hour when the giant one-armed rock demon bounded into the clearing. It gave a great howl, sweeping lesser demons aside as it stomped toward the cave mouth, roaring a challenge. Kieran groaned, retreating to the back of the cave.
That one has your scent now, Reagan warned. It'll follow you forever, waiting for you to drop your guard.
Arlen looked at the monster for a long moment, considering the messenger's words. The demon snarled and struck hard at the barrier, but the wards flared and knocked it away. Kieran whimpered, but Arlen rose and walked up to the mouth of the cave. He met the Corling's eyes and slowly raised his hands, bringing them together suddenly in a loud clap, mocking the demon with his two limbs.
"Let it waste its time," he said as the demon howled in impotent rage. "It won't get me."
They continued on the road for almost a week. Reagan turned them north, passing through the foothills of the mountain range, ascending ever higher. Now and again, Reagan would stop to hunt, felling small game from great distances with his thin throwing spears. Most nights they stayed in shelters noted in Gregg's log, though twice they simply camped in the road. Like any animal, Reagan's mare was terrified by the stalking demons, but she didn't try to pull free from her hobble.
"She deserves a name," Arlen said for the 100th time, pointing at the steady horse.
"Fine, fine," Reagan finally conceded, ruffling Arlen's hair.
"You can name her."
Arlen smiled.
"Night Eye," he said.
Reagan looked at the horse and nodded.
"It's a good name," he agreed.
Chapter 9. Fort Milne, 319 AR. The terrain grew steadily rockier as the tiny lumps on the horizon rose higher and higher. Reagan hadn't exaggerated when he said 100 Boggins Hills could fit in just one mountain, and the range stretched as far as Arlen could see. The air grew cooler as they climbed. Strong gusts of wind whipped through the hills. Arlen looked back and saw the whole world spread out before him like a map. He imagined traveling through those lands with only a spear and a messenger bag. When they finally caught sight of Fort Milne, Arlen couldn't believe his eyes. Despite Reagan's tales, he had still assumed it would be like Tibbetts Brook, only larger. He nearly fell from the cart as the fortress city rose up before them, looming over the road. Fort Milne was built into the base of a mountain, overlooking a broad valley. Another mountain, twin to the one Milne abutted, faced the city from across the valley. The circular wall, some 30 feet high, surrounded the city, though many of the buildings within thrust still higher into the sky. The closer they got to the city, the more it spread out, the wall going for miles in each direction. The walls were painted with the largest wards Arlen had ever seen. His eyes followed the invisible lines connecting one ward to another,
forming a web that would make the wall impervious to Corlings. But despite the triumph of achievement, the walls disappointed Arlen. The free cities weren't really free at all. Walls that kept the Corlings out also kept the people in. At least in Tibbetts Brook, the prison walls were invisible. "What keeps wind demons from flying over the wall?" Arlen asked. "The top of the wall is set with ward posts that weave a canopy over the city," Reagan said. Arlen realized he should have figured that out without Reagan's help. He had more questions, but he kept them to himself, his sharp mind already working on probable solutions. It was well past high sun when they finally reached the city. Reagan pointed out a column of smoke farther up the mountain, miles above the city. "The Duke's Mines," he said. "It's a village in itself, larger than your Tibbetts Brook. They're not self-sufficient, but that's how the Duke likes it. Caravans come and go almost every week. Food goes up, and salt, metal, and coal come down." The lower wall branched out from the main city, running in a broad swath around the valley. Arlen could make out ward posts and the top of neat green rows. "The Great Gardens and the Duke's Orchard," Reagan noted. The gate was open wide as workers came and went, and the guards waved as they approached. They were tall, like Reagan, and wore dented metal helms and old boiled leather over thick woolens. Both carried spears, but they held them more like showpieces than weapons. "Aye, messenger," one cried. "Welcome back." "James, Warren," Reagan nodded at them. "Duke expected you days ago," James said. "We were worried when you didn't arrive." "Thought the demons got me," Reagan laughed. "Not a chance. There was a Corling attack in the hamlet I visited on the way back from Angiers. We stayed on a bit to help out." "Picked up a stray while you were there?" Warren asked with a grin. "A little gift for your wife while she waits for you to make her a mother?" Reagan scowled and the guard drew back. "I meant no offense," he said quickly. "Then I suggest you avoid saying things that tend to offend, servant," Reagan replied tightly. Warren paled and nodded quickly. "I found him out on the road, actually," Reagan said, ruffling Arlen's hair and grinning as if nothing tense had just passed. Arlen liked that about Reagan. He was quick to laugh and held no grudges, but he demanded respect and let you know where you stood. Arlen wanted to be like that one day. "On the road?" James asked in disbelief. "Days from anywhere," Reagan cried. "The boy can ward better than some messengers I know." Arlen swelled with pride at the compliment. "And you, jongleur?" Warren asked Kieran. "Like your first taste of the naked knight?" Kieran scowled, and the guards laughed. "That good, eh?" Warren asked. "Light's wasting," Reagan said. "Send word to Mother Joan that we'll come to the palace after I deliver the rice and stop home for a bath and a decent meal." The men saluted and let them pass into the city. Despite his initial disappointment, the grandeur of Milne soon overwhelmed Arlen. Buildings soared into the air, dwarfing anything he had ever seen before, and cobbles covered the streets instead of hard-packed dirt. Corlings couldn't rise through worked stone, but Arlen couldn't imagine the effort needed to cut and fit hundreds of thousands of stones. In Tibbetts Brook, most every structure was wood, with foundations of piled stone and roofs of thatch with plates for wards. Here, most everything was cut stone and reeked of age. Despite the warded outer walls, every building was warded individually, some in fantastic works of art, and others in simple functionality. The air in the city was rank, thick with the stench of garbage, dung fires, and sweat. Arlen tried holding his breath, but soon gave up and settled for breathing through his mouth. Kieran, on the other hand, seemed to breathe comfortably for the first time. Reagan led the way to a marketplace where Arlen saw more people than he had in his entire life. Hundreds of Rusko hogs called to him from all sides, Buy this, try that, a special price just for you. They were all tall, giants compared to the folk of the brook. They passed carts of fruits and vegetables, the likes of which Arlen had never seen, and so many sellers of clothes that he thought it must be all the Milanese thought about. There were paintings and carvings, too, so intricate he wondered how anyone had the time to make them. Regan brought them to a merchant on the far end of the market who bore the symbol of a shield on his tent. "The Duke's man," Regan advised as they pulled up to the cart. "Regan," the merchant called. "What do you have for me today?" "Marsh rice," Regan said. "Taxes from the brook to pay for the Duke's salt." "Been to see Roscoe Hogg," the merchant said, more than asked. "That crook still robbing the town he's blind?" "You know Hogg?" Regan asked. The merchant laughed. "I testified before the Mother's Council 10 years ago to have his merchant license pulled, after he tried to pass on a shipment of grain thick with rats," he said. "He left town soon after and resurfaced at the ends of the world. And the same thing happened in Angiers, which is why he was in Milne to begin with." "A good thing we checked the rice," Regan muttered. They haggled for some time over the going rates for rice and salt. Finally, the merchant gave in, admitting that Regan had gotten the better of Hogg. He gave the messenger a jingling pouch of coins to make up the difference. "Can Arlen drive the cart from here?" Kieran asked. Regan glanced at him and nodded. He tossed a purse of coins to Kieran, who caught it deftly, and hopped off the cart. Regan shook his head as Kieran disappeared into the crowd. "Not the worst jongleur," he said, "but he doesn't have the stones for the road." He remounted and led Arlen through the busy streets. Arlen felt suffocated by the press as they moved down a particularly crowded street. He noticed some people dressed only in tattered rags, despite the chill mountain air. "What are they doing?" Arlen asked, watching them hold empty cups out to passers-by. "Begging," Regan said. "Not everyone in Milne can afford to buy food." "Can't we just give them some of ours?" Arlen asked. Regan sighed. "It's not that simple, Arlen," he said. "The soil here isn't fertile enough to feed even half the people. We need grain from Fort Risen, fish from Lacton, fruit and livestock from Angiers. The other cities don't just give all that away. It goes to those who work a trade and earn the money to pay for it. The merchants. Merchants hire servants to do for them, and feed, clothe, and house them out of their own purse." He gestured at a man wrapped in rough, filthy cloth holding out a cracked wooden bowl to passers-by who moved to avoid him, refusing eye contact. "So unless you're a royal or a holy man, if you don't work, you end up like that." Arlen nodded as if he understood, but he didn't really. People ran out of credits at the general store in Tibbetts Brook all the time, but even Hogg didn't let them starve. They came to a house, and Regan signaled Arlen to stop the cart. It wasn't a large house compared to many Arlen had seen in Milne, but it was still impressive by Tibbetts Brook standards, made entirely of stone and standing 2 full stories. "Is this where you live?" Arlen asked. Regan shook his head. He dismounted and went to the door, knocking sharply. A moment later it was answered by a young woman with long brown hair woven into a tight braid. She was tall and sturdy, like everyone in Milne, and wore a high-necked dress that fell to her ankles and was tight across her bosom. Arlen couldn't tell if she was pretty. He was about to decide that she wasn't when she smiled, and her whole face changed. "Regan!" she cried, throwing her arms around him. "You came, thank the Creator!" "Of course I came, Jinya," Regan said. "We messengers take care of our own."
"I'm no messenger," Jinya said.
"You were married to one, and that's the same. Greg died a messenger, the guild's ruling be damned."
Jinya looked sad, and Regan changed the subject quickly, striding over to the cart and unloading the remaining stores. "I brought you good marsh rice, salt, meat, and fish," he said, carrying the items over and setting them just inside her doorway. Arlen scurried to help. And this, Reagan added, pulling the sack of gold and silver he had gotten from Hogg out of his belt. He threw in the little pouch from the Duke's merchant as well. Jenna's eyes widened as she opened it.
"Oh, Reagan," she said, "it's too much. I can't..."
"You can and you will," Reagan ordered, cutting her off. "It's the least I can do." Jenya's eyes filled with tears.
"I've no way to thank you," she said. "I've been so scared. Penning for the guild doesn't cover everything, and without Greg, I thought I might have to go back to begging."
"There, there," Reagan said, patting her shoulder. "My brothers and I will never let that happen. I'll take you into my own household before I let you fall so far," he promised.
"Oh, Reagan, you would do that?" she asked.
"There's one last thing," Reagan said. "A gift from Rusko Hogg." He held up the ring. "He wants you to write him and let him know you got it." Jenya's eyes began to water again, looking at the beautiful ring. "Greg was well-loved," Reagan said, slipping the ring onto her finger. "Let this ring be a symbol of his memory. The food and money should last your family a good long while. Perhaps in that time you'll even find another husband and become a mother. But if things ever grow so dark that you feel you must sell that ring, you come to me first. You understand?" Jenya nodded, but her eyes were down, still dripping as she caressed the ring. "Promise me," Reagan ordered.
"I promise," Jenya said.
Reagan nodded, hugging her one last time. "I'll look in on you when I can," he said. She was still crying as they left. Arlen stared back at her as they went. "You look confused," Reagan said.
"I guess I am," Arlen agreed.
"Jenya's family were beggars," Reagan explained. "Her father's blind and her mother's sickly. They had the fortune, though, to have a healthy, attractive daughter. She brought herself and her parents up two classes when she married Greg. He took the three of them into his home, and though he never had the choicest roots, he made enough for them to get by and be happy." He shook his head. "Now, though, she has rent to pay and three mouths to feed on her own. She can't stray far from home, either, because her parents can't do for themselves."
"It's good of you to help her," Arlen said, feeling a little better. "She was pretty when she smiled."
"You can't help everyone, Arlen," Reagan said. "But you should make every effort to help those you can." Arlen nodded. They wound their way up a hill until they reached a large manse. A gated wall, 6 feet high, surrounded the sprawling property, and the great house itself was 3 stories high and had dozens of windows, all reflecting light from their glass. It was bigger than the great hall on Boggins Hill, and that could hold everyone in Tibbetts Brook for the solstice feast. The manse and the wall around it were painted with brightly colored wards. Such a magnificent place, Arlen decided. Must be the home of the Duke.
"My ma'am had a cup of warded glass, hard as steel," he said, looking up at the windows as a thin man came scurrying up from inside the grounds to open the gate. "She kept it hidden, but sometimes she took it out when company came to show how it glittered."
They rode past a garden untouched by crawling mischief, where several hands were digging vegetables. "This is one of the only manses in Milne with all glass windows," Reagan said proudly. "I'd pay a lot to ward them not to break."
"I know the trick," Arlen said, "but you need a crawling to touch the glass to charge it."
Reagan chuckled and shook his head. "Maybe not, then." There were smaller buildings on the grounds as well, stone huts with smoking chimneys and people going to and fro like a tiny village. Dirty children scampered about, and women kept watch over them while tending their chores. They rode to the stables, and a groom was there in a second to take Nighteye's reins. He bowed and scraped to Reagan as if Reagan were a king in a story.
"I thought we were going to stop by your house before visiting the Duke," Arlen asked.
Reagan laughed. "This is my house, Arlen. Do you think I risk the open road for nothing?" Arlen looked back at the house, his eyes bulging.
"This is all yours?" he asked.
"All of it," Reagan confirmed.
Dukes are free with their coin to those who stare down Corlings.
But Greg's house was so small, Arlen protested.
Greg was a good man, Reagan said, but he was never more than a passable messenger. He was content to make a run to Tibbetts Brook each year and shuttle to the local hamlets in between. A man like that might support his family, but no more. The only reason there was so much profit for Jenya was that I paid for the extra goods I sold Hogg out of my own purse. Greg used to have to borrow from the guild, and they took a hard cut. A tall man opened the door to the house with a bow. He was stone-faced, wearing a faded blue coat of dyed wool. His face and clothes were clean, a sharp contrast to those in the yard. As soon as they entered, a boy not much older than Arlen sprang to his feet. He ran to a bell rope at the base of a broad marble stair. Chimes rang through the house. "I see your luck has held one more time," the woman called a moment later. She had dark hair and piercing blue eyes. She wore a deep blue gown, finer than anything Arlen had ever seen, and her wrists and throat sparkled with jewels. Her smile was cold as she regarded them from the marble balcony above the foyer. Arlen had never seen a woman so beautiful or graceful. "My wife Alyssa," Reagan advised quietly. "A reason to return, and a reason to leave." Arlen was unsure if he was joking. The woman didn't seem pleased to see them. "One of these times the Corlings will have you," Melissa said as she descended the stairs. "Then I'll finally be free to wed my young lover." "Never happen," Reagan said with a smile, drawing her close for a kiss. Turning to Arlen, he explained, "Alyssa dreams of the day when she'll inherit my fortune. I guard against the Corlings as much to spite her as to protect myself." Alyssa laughed, and Arlen relaxed. "Who's this?" she asked. "A stray to save you the work of filling my belly with a child of our own?" "The only work is melting your frozen petticoats, my dear," Reagan shot back. "May I present Arlen of Tibbetts Brook? I met him on the road."
"On the road?" Alyssa asked. "He's just a child." "I'm not a child," Arlen shouted, then immediately felt foolish.
Reagan eyed him wryly, and he dropped his gaze. Alyssa gave no sign that she heard the outburst.
"Doff your armor and find the bath," she ordered her husband. "You smell like sweat and rust. I'll see to our guest."
As Reagan left, Alyssa called a servant to prepare Arlen a snack. Reagan seemed to have more servants than there were people in Tibbetts Brook. They cut him slices of cold ham and a thick crust of bread, with clotted cream and milk to wash it down. Alyssa watched him eat, but Arlen couldn't think of anything to say, and kept his attention on his plate. As he was finishing the cream, a serving woman in a dress of the same blue as the men's jackets entered and bowed to Alyssa.
"Master Reagan awaits you upstairs," she said.
"Thank you, Mother," Alyssa replied. Her face took on a strange cast for a moment as she absently ran her fingers over her stomach. Then she smiled and looked at Arlen.
"Take our guest to the bath," she ordered,
"and don't let him up for air until you can tell what color his skin is." She laughed and swept out of the room. Arlen, used to standing in a trough and dumping cold water over himself, was out of sorts at the sight of Reagan's deep stone tub. He waited as the serving woman, Margaret, poured a kettle of boiling water in to take the chill from his soak. She was tall, like everyone in Milne, with kind eyes and honey-colored hair just hinting at gray peeking from underneath her bonnet. She turned her back while Arlen undressed and got into the tub. She gasped as she saw the stitched wounds on his back and quickly moved to inspect them.
"Ow!"
Arlen shouted as she pinched the uppermost wound.
"Don't be such a baby,"
she scolded, rubbing her thumb and forefinger together and sniffing at them. Arlen bit down as she repeated the process down his back.
"You're luckier than you know," she said at last.
When Reagan told me you were hurt, I thought it might just be a scratch, but this...
She tisked at him. Didn't your mother teach you not to be outside at night?
Arlen's retort died on a sniffle. He bit his lip, determined not to cry. Margaret noticed and immediately softened her tone.
These are healing well, she said of his wounds.
She took a cake of soap and began to gently wash them. Arlen gritted his teeth. When you're done in the bath, I'll prepare a poultice and fresh bandages for you. Arlen nodded.
Are you Alyssa's mother? He asked.
The woman laughed.
Creator, boy, what gave you that idea?
She called you mother, Arlen said.
Because I am, Margaret said proudly. Two sons and three daughters. One of them soon to be a mother herself. She shook her head sadly. Poor Alyssa, all her wealth and still a daughter, and her on the dark side of 30. It breaks the heart.
Is being a man so important? Arlen asked.
The woman regarded him as if he had asked if air were important.
What could be more important than motherhood? She asked. It's every woman's duty to produce children and keep the city strong.
That's why mothers get the best rations and first pick of the morning market. It's why all the Duke's counselors are mothers. Men are good for breaking and building, but politics and papers are best left to women who've been to the mother's school.
Why, it's mothers that vote to choose a new Duke when the old one passes.
Then why ain't Alyssa one? Arlen asked.
It's not for lack of trying, Margaret admitted. I'll wager she's at it right now.
6 weeks on the road will make any man a bull, and I brewed fertility tea and left it on her nightstand. Maybe it'll help, though any fool knows the best time to make a baby is just before dawn.
Then why haven't they made one? Arlen asked.
He knew making babies had something to do with the games Renna and Benny had wanted to play, but he was still vague on the process.
Only the Creator knows, Margaret said.
Alyssa might be barren, or it might be Reagan, though that would be a shame. There's a shortage of good men like him.
Milne needs his sons.
She sighed. Alyssa's lucky he hasn't left her. I've gotten a child and one of the servant girls. Creator knows they're willing.
He would leave his wife?
Arlen was aghast. Don't look so surprised, boy, Margaret said. Men need heirs, and they'll get them any way they can. Duke Euchre is on his third wife, and still only daughters to show for it.
She shook her head.
Not Reagan, though. They fight like Corling sometimes, but he loves Alyssa like the sun itself. He'd never leave. Nor Alyssa, despite what she's given up.
Given up? Arlen asked.
She was a noble, you know, Margaret said. Her mother is on the Duke's council. Alyssa could have served the Duke, too, if she'd married another noble and got with child. But she married down to be with Reagan, against her mother's wishes. They haven't spoken since. Alyssa's merchant now, if well-moneyed. Denied the mother's school, she'll never hold any position in the city, much less one in the Duke's service. Arlen was quiet while Margaret rinsed out his wounds and collected his clothes off the tiles. She tisked as she inspected the rips and stains. "I'll mend these as best I can while you soak," she promised, and left him to his bath. While she was gone, Arlen tried to make sense of everything she had told him, but there was too much he didn't understand. Margaret reminded Arlen a little of Catrin Hogg, Roscoe's daughter.
"She'd tell you every secret in the world if it let her hear her own voice a moment longer," Sylvie used to say.
The woman returned later with fresh, if ill-fitting, clothes. She bandaged his wounds and helped him dress, despite his protests. He had to roll up the tunic sleeves to find his hands and cuff his breeches to keep from tripping, but Arlen felt clean for the first time in weeks. He shared an early supper with Reagan and Alyssa. Reagan had trimmed his beard, tied back his hair, and donned a fine white shirt with a deep blue suede jacket and breeches. A pig had been slaughtered on Reagan's arrival, and the table was soon laden with pork chops, ribs, rashers of bacon,
and succulent sausages. Flagons of chilled ale and clear, cold water were served. Alyssa frowned when Reagan signaled a servant to pour Arlen an ale, but she said nothing. She sipped wine from a glass so delicate, Arlen was afraid her slender fingers would break it. There was crusty bread, whiter than he had ever seen, and bowls of boiled turnips and potatoes, thick with butter. As he looked out over the food, his mouth watering, Arlen couldn't help but remember people out in the city begging for something to eat. Still, his hunger soon overcame his guilt, and he sampled everything, filling his plate again and again.
"Creator, where are you putting it all?"
Alyssa asked, clapping her hands in amusement as she watched Arlen clean another plate.
"Is there a chasm in your belly?"
"Ignore her, Arlen," Reagan advised. "Women will fuss all day in the kitchen, yet fear to take more than a nibble lest they seem indelicate. Men know better how to appreciate a meal."
"He's right, you know," Alyssa said with a roll of her eyes. "Women can hardly appreciate the subtleties of life as men do."
Reagan started and spilled his ale, and Arlen realized that she had kicked him under the table. Arlen decided he liked her. After supper, a page appeared, wearing a gray tabard with the Duke's shield emblazoned on the front. He reminded Reagan of his appointment, and the messenger sighed, but assured the page they would be along directly.
"Arlen is hardly dressed to meet the Duke," Alyssa fussed. "One doesn't go before his grace looking like a beggar."
"There's nothing for it, love," Reagan replied. "We have only a few hours before sunset. We can hardly have a tailor come in time." Alyssa refused to accept that. She stared at the boy for a long moment, then snapped her fingers, striding out of the room. She returned soon after with a blue doublet and a pair of polished leather boots.
"One of our pages is near your age," she told Arlen as she helped him into the jacket and boots.
The sleeves of the doublet were short, and the boots pinched his feet, but Lady Alyssa seemed satisfied. She ran a comb through his hair and stepped back.
"Good enough," she said with a smile.
"Mind your manners before the Duke, Arlen," she counseled. Arlen, feeling awkward in the ill-fitting clothes, smiled and nodded. The Duke's keep was a warded fortress within the warded fortress of Milne. The outer wall was fitted stone, over 20 feet high, heavily warded and patrolled by armored spearmen. They rode through the gate into a wide courtyard which circled the palace. Dwarfing Reagan's manse, the palace had 4 floors and towers that reached twice that high. Broad, sharp wards marked every stone. The windows glittered with glass. Men in armor patrolled the yard, and pages in the Duke's colors scurried to and fro. 100 men sweated out in the yard, carpenters, masons, blacksmiths, and butchers. Arlen saw grain stores and livestock, even broad gardens far larger than Reagan's. It seemed to Arlen that if he should close the gate, the Duke could last forever in his keep. The noise and smell of the yard died as the heavy doors of the palace closed behind them. The entrance hall had a wide running carpet and tapestries on the cool stone walls. Save for a few guards, there were no men to be seen. Dozens of women moved about instead, their wide skirts swishing as they went about their business. Some were doing figures on slates, while others penned the results in heavy books. A few, more richly dressed than the rest, strolled about imperiously, watching the others at their work.
"The Duke is in the audience chamber," one of them advised. "He's been expecting you for some time."
A long line of people waited outside the Duke's audience chamber. It was mostly women holding quills and sheaves of paper, but there were a few well-dressed men as well.
"Lesser petitioners," Reagan advised,
all hoping for a moment of the Duke's time before the evening bell rings and they're escorted out. The lesser petitioners seemed acutely aware that there was little daylight left, and openly argued among themselves as to who ought to go next. But chatter died as they caught sight of Reagan. As the messenger walked past, bypassing the line completely, all the petitioners fell silent, then followed in his wake like dogs eager for a feeding. They followed right up to the entranceway, where a glare from the guards brought them up short. They crowded around the entrance to listen as Reagan and Arlen entered. Arlen felt dwarfed by the audience chamber of Duke Euchre of Milne. The domed ceiling of the room was stories high, and ensconced torches rested on the great columns surrounding Euchre's throne. Each column had wards carved into the marble. "Greater petitioners," Reagan said quietly, indicating the men and women moving about the room. "They tend to cluster." He nodded to a large group of men standing close to the door. "Merchant princes," he said. "Spreading gold around for the right to stand around the palace, sniffing for news or a noble to marry off their daughters to." "There," he nodded toward a cluster of old women standing ahead of the merchants, "the Council of Mothers, waiting to give Euchre his day's reports." Closer to the throne was a group of sandaled men in plain brown robes standing with quiet dignity. A few spoke in murmurs as others took down their every word. "Every court needs its holy men," Reagan explained. He pointed at last to a swarm of richly dressed people buzzing about the Duke, attended by an army of servants laden with trays of food and drink. "Royals," Reagan said. "The Duke's nephews and cousins and second cousins thrice removed, all clamoring for his ear and dreaming of what will happen if Euchre vacates his throne without an heir. The Duke hates them."
"Why doesn't he send them away?" Arlen asked.
"Because they're royals," Reagan said, as if that explained everything. They were halfway to the Duke's throne when a tall woman moved to intercept them. Her hair was kept back in a cloth wrap, and her face was pinched and lined with wrinkles so deep it looked as if wards were carved into her cheeks. She moved with arched dignity, but a little wattle of flesh beneath her chin shook of its own accord. She had Celia's air about her, a woman accustomed to giving orders and having them obeyed without question. She looked down at Arlen and sniffed as if she had smelled a dung heap. Her gaze snapped up at Reagan. "Euchre's Chamberlain Joan," Reagan muttered while they were still out of earshot. "Mother, royal, and an eighth breed of Corling. Don't stop walking unless I do, or she'll have you waiting in the stables while I see the Duke." "Your page will have to wait in the hall, messenger," Joan said, stepping in front of them. "He's not my page," Reagan said, continuing forward. Arlen kept pace, and the Chamberlain was forced to sacrifice her dignity to scurry out of the way. "His Grace doesn't have time for every stray off the street, Reagan," she hissed, hurrying to keep pace with the messenger. "Who is he?" Reagan stopped, and Arlen stopped with him. He turned and glared at the woman, leaning in. Mother Joan might have been tall, but Reagan was taller, and he outweighed her thrice over. The sheer menace of his presence shrank her back involuntarily. "He is who I have chosen to bring," he said through his teeth. He thrust a satchel filled with letters at her, and Joan took it reflexively. As she did, the merchants and mother's council swarmed her, along with the tender's acolytes. The royals noted the movement and made comments or gestures to those next to them. Suddenly, half their entourage broke away, and Arlen realized those were just well-dressed servants. The royals acted as if nothing of note was happening, but their servants shoved as hard as any to get close to that satchel. Joan passed the letters on to a servant of her own and hurried toward the throne to announce Reagan, though she needn't have bothered. Reagan's entrance had caused enough of a stir that the man couldn't have failed to note him. Euchre was watching as they approached. The Duke was a heavy-set man in his late 50s, with salt-and-pepper hair and a thick beard. He wore a green tunic, freshly stained with grease from his fingers, but richly embroidered with gold thread, and a fur-lined cloak. His fingers glittered with rings, and about his brow he wore a circlet of gold. "At last you deigned to grace us with your presence," the Duke called out, though it seemed he was speaking more to the rest of the room than to Reagan.
Indeed, the observation had the royals nodding and murmuring among themselves, and caused several heads to pop up from the cluster around the male. "Was my business not pressing enough?" he asked. Regan advanced to the dais, meeting the Duke's gaze with a stony one of his own. 45 days from here to Angiers, and back by way of Tibbetts Brook," he said loudly. 30 and 7 nights slept outside, while Corling slashed at my wards." He never took his eyes from the Duke, but Arlen knew he, too, was speaking to the room. Most of those assembled blanched and shuddered at his words. 6 weeks gone from my home, Your Grace," Regan said, lowering his voice by half, but still carrying to all ears. "Do you begrudge me a bath and a meal with my wife?" The Duke hesitated, his eyes flicking about the court. Finally, he gave a great booming laugh. "Of course not," he called. "An offended duke can make a man's life difficult, but not half so much as an offended wife." The tension shattered as the court broke into laughter. "I would speak to my messenger alone," the Duke commanded, once the laughter faded. There were grumbles from those eager for news, but Joan signaled her servants to leave with the letters, and that took most of the court with her. The royals lingered a moment until Joan cracked her hands together. The retort made them jump, and they filed out as quickly as dignity would allow. "Stay," Regan murmured to Arlen, stopping a respectful distance from the throne. Joan signaled the guards, who pulled the heavy doors closed, remaining inside. Unlike the men at the gate, these looked alert and professional. Joan moved to stand beside her lord. "Don't ever do that before my court again," Euchre growled when the rest were gone. The messenger gave a slight bow to acknowledge the command, but it looked insincere, even to Arlen. The boy was in awe. Regan was utterly fearless. "There is news from the brook, Your Grace," Regan began.
"The brook?" Euchre burst out.
"What do I care about the brook? What word from Rhinebeck?" "They've had a rough winter without the salt," Regan went on, as if the Duke hadn't spoken. "And there was an attack—" "Knight, Regan," Euchre barked. "Rhinebeck's answer could affect all Milne for years to come, so spare me birth lists and harvest counts of some miserable little backwater." Arlen gasped and drew protectively behind Regan, who gripped his arm reassuringly. Euchre pressed the attack. "Did they discover gold in Tibbetts Brook?" he demanded.
"No, my lord," Regan replied.
"But did Sunny Pasture open a coal mine?"
Euchre cut him off.
"No, my lord." "Did they rediscover the lost combat wards?"
Regan shook his head.
"Of course not." "Did you even haul back enough rice to bring me profit to cover the cost of your services to go there and back?"
Euchre asked.
"No," Regan scowled.
"Good," Euchre said, rubbing his hands as if to remove the dust from them.
"Then we need not concern ourselves with Tibbetts Brook for another year and a half."
"A year and a half is too long," Regan dared to persist. "The folk need—"
"Go for free, then," the Duke cut him off, "so I can afford it."
When Regan didn't immediately answer, Euchre smiled widely, knowing he had won the exchange.
"What word from Angiers?" he demanded.
"I have a letter from Duke Rhinebeck," Regan sighed, reaching into his coat. He drew forth a slim tube sealed with wax, but the Duke waved at him impatiently.
"Just tell me, Regan, yes or no?"
Regan's eyes narrowed.
"No, my lord," he said.
"His answer is no. The last 2 shipments were lost, along with all but a handful of the men. Duke Rhinebeck cannot afford to send another. His men can only log so fast, and he needs the timber more than he needs salt." The Duke's face reddened, and Arlen thought it might burst.
"Damn it, Regan," he shouted, slamming down his fist. "I need that wood!"
"His Grace has decided that he needs it more for the rebuilding of Riverbridge," Regan said calmly, "on the south side of the Dividing River." Duke Euchre hissed, and his eyes took on a murderous gleam.
This is the work of Rhinebeck's first minister, Joan advised. Jansen's been trying to get Rhinebeck a cut of the bridge tolls for years.
And why settle for a cut when you can have all? Euchre agreed. What did you say I would do when you gave me this news?
Regan shrugged.
It's not the place of a messenger to conjecture. What would you have had me say?
That people in wooden fortresses shouldn't set fires in other men's yards, Euchre growled. I don't need to remind you, Regan, how important that wood is to Milne. Our supply of coal dwindles, and without fuel all the ore in the mines is useless, and half the city will freeze. I'll torch his new river bridge myself before it comes to that.
Regan bowed in acknowledgement of the fact. Duke Rhinebeck knows this, he said. He empowered me to make a counter-offer.
And that is? Euchre asked, raising an eyebrow.
Materials to rebuild Riverbridge and half the tolls, Joan guessed before Regan could open his mouth. She squinted at the messenger.
And Riverbridge stays on the Angerian side of the dividing.
Regan nodded.
Knight, Euchre swore. Creator, Regan, whose side are you on?
I'm a messenger, Regan replied proudly. I take no sides. I simply report what I've been told.
Duke Euchre surged to his feet.
Then tell me what in the dark of night I pay you for, he demanded.
Regan tilted his head.
Would you prefer to go in person, Your Grace? He asked mildly.
The Duke paled at that and didn't reply.
Arlen could feel the power of Regan's simple comment. If possible, his desire to become a messenger strengthened further.
The Duke finally nodded in resignation.
I'll think on this, he said at last. The hour grows late. You are dismissed.
There is one more thing, my lord, Regan added, beckoning Arlen to come forward. But Joan signaled the guards to open the doors, and the greater petitioners swarmed back into the room. The Duke's attention was already turned away from the messenger. Regan intercepted Joan as she left Euchre's side.
Mother, he said, about the boy.
I'm very busy, messenger, Joan sniffed. Perhaps you should choose to bring him sometime when I'm less so.
She swept away from them with her head thrown back.
One of the merchants approached them. He was a bear-like man with only one eye, his other socket a gnarl of scarred flesh. On his breast was a symbol, a man on horseback with spear and satchel.
"It's good to see you safe, Regan," the man said. "You'll be by the guild in the morning to give your report?"
"Guildmaster Malcolm," Regan said, bowing, "I'm glad to see you. I encountered this boy Arlen on the road."
"Between cities?" the guildmaster asked in surprise.
"You should know better, boy."
"Several days between cities," Regan clarified.
"The boy wards better than many messengers."
Malcolm arched his one eyebrow at that.
"He wants to be a messenger," Regan pressed.
"You couldn't ask for a more honorable career," Malcolm told Arlen.
"He has no one in Milne," Regan said. "I thought he might apprentice with the guild."
"Now, Regan," Malcolm said, "you know as well as any that we only apprentice registered warders. Try Guildmaster Vincent."
"The boy can already ward," Regan argued, though his tone was more respectful than it had been with Duke Euchre.
Guildmaster Malcolm was even larger than Regan, and didn't look like he could be intimidated by talk of knights outside.
"Then he shouldn't have any trouble getting the Warders Guild to register him," Malcolm said, turning away.
"I'll see you in the morning," he called over his shoulder.
Regan looked around, spotting another man in the cluster of merchants.
"Lift your feet, Arlen," he growled, striding across the room.
"Guildmaster Vincent," he called as he walked.
The man looked up at their approach and moved away from his fellows to greet them. He bowed to Regan, but it was a bow of respect, not deference. Vincent had an oily black goatee, and his hair slicked straight back. Rings glittered on his chubby fingers. The symbol on his breast was a key ward, a ward that served as foundation to all the other wards in a web. "What can I do for you, Regan?" the guildmaster asked.
"This boy Arlen is from Tibbetts Brook," Regan said, gesturing to Arlen. "An orphan from a coiling attack. He has no family in Milne, but he wishes to apprentice as a messenger."
"That's all well, Regan, but what's it to do with me?" Vincent asked, never more than glancing Arlen's way.
"Malcolm won't take him unless he's registered to ward," Regan said.
"Well, that is a problem," Vincent agreed.
"The boy can already ward," Regan said. "If you could see your way to..." Vincent was already shaking his head.
"I'm sorry, Regan, but you're not about to convince me that some backwater bumpkin can ward well enough for me to register him."
"The boy's wards cut the arm off a rock demon," Regan said.
Vincent laughed. "Unless you have the arm with you, Regan, you can save that tale for the jongleurs."
"Could you find him an apprenticeship, then?" the messenger asked.
"Can he pay the apprenticeship fee?" Vincent asked.
"He's an orphan off the road," Regan protested.
"Perhaps I can find a warder to take him on as a servant," the guildmaster offered. Regan scowled.
"Thanks all the same," he said, ushering Arlen away.
They hurried back to Regan's manse, the sun fast setting. Arlen watched as the busy streets of Milne emptied, people carefully checking wards and barring their doors. Even with cobbled streets and thick warded walls, everyone still locked themselves up at night.
"I can't believe you talked to the Duke like that," Arlen said as they went.
Regan chuckled. "First rule of being a messenger, Arlen," he said. "Merchants and royals may pay your fee, but they'll walk all over you if you let them. You need to act like a king in their presence, and never forget who it is risking their life."
"It worked with Euchre," Arlen agreed.
Regan scowled at the name.
"Selfish pig," he spat. "He doesn't care about anything but his own pockets."
"It's okay," Arlen said. "The brooks survived without salt last fall. They can do it again."
"Perhaps," Regan conceded. "But they shouldn't have to."
"And you? A good duke would have asked why I brought a boy with me into his chamber. A good duke would have made you a ward of the throne so you didn't wind up begging on the street. And Malcolm was no better. Would it have cored him to test your skill? And Vincent? If it had the ripping fee, that greedy bastard would have had a master to apprentice you by sunset."
"Servant," he says.
"Hath an apprentice a servant?" Arlen asked.
"Not in the slightest," Regan said. "Apprentices are merchant class. They master a trade and then go into business for themselves or with another master. Servants will never be anything but unless they marry up. And I'll be corespawned before I let them turn you into one."
He lapsed into silence, and Arlen, though he was still confused, thought it best not to press him further.
It was full dark not long after they crossed Regan's wards, and Margaret showed Arlen to a guest room that was half the size of Jeff's entire house. At the center was a bed so high that Arlen had to hop to get in, and having never slept on anything but the ground or a hard straw pallet, he was shocked when he sank into the soft mattress. He drifted off to slumber quickly, but awoke soon after at the sound of raised voices. He slipped from the bed and left his room, following the sound. The halls of the great manse were empty, the servants having retired for the night. Arlen went to the top of the stairs, the voices becoming clearer. It was Regan and Elissa.
"Taking him in, and that's final," he heard Elissa say. "Messaging's no job for a boy anyway."
"It's what he wants," Regan insisted. Elissa snorted.
"Pawning Arlen off on someone else won't alleviate your guilt over bringing him to Milne when you should have taken him home."
"Demon dung," Regan snapped.
"You just want someone to mother day and night."
"Don't you dare turn this back on me," Elissa hissed.
"When you decided not to take Arlen back to Tibbetts Brook, you took responsibility for him. It's time to own up to that and stop looking for someone else to care for him."
Arlen strained to hear, but there was no response from Regan for some time. He wanted to go down and barge into the conversation. He knew Elissa meant well, but he was growing tired of adults planning out his life for him. Fine, Reagan said at last. What if I send him to Cobb? He won't encourage the boy to be a messenger. I'll put up the full fee, and we can visit the shop regularly to keep an eye on him.
I think that's a great idea, Alyssa agreed, the peevishness gone from her voice. But there's no reason Arlen can't stay here instead of on a hard bench in some cluttered workshop.
Apprenticeships aren't meant to be comfortable, Reagan said. He'll need to be there from dawn till dusk if he's to master wardcraft, and if he follows through with his plans to be a messenger, he'll need all the training he can get.
Fine, Alyssa huffed, but her voice softened a moment later. Now come put a baby in my belly, she husked.
Arlen hurried back to his room. As always, Arlen's eyes opened before dawn, but for a moment he thought he was still asleep, drifting on a cloud. Then he remembered where he was and stretched out, feeling the delicious softness of the feathers stuffed into the mattress and pillow, and the warmth of the thick quilt. The fire in the room's hearth had burned down to embers. The temptation to stay abed was strong, but his bladder helped force him from the soft embrace. He slipped to the cold floor and fetched the pots from under the bed, as Margaret had instructed him. He made his water in one and waste in the other, leaving them by the door to be collected for use in the gardens. The soil in Milne was stony, and its people wasted nothing. Arlen went to the window. He'd stared at it until his eyes drooped the night before, but the glass still fascinated him. It looked like nothing at all, but was hard and unyielding to the touch, like a ward net. He traced a finger along the glass, making a line in the morning condensation. Remembering the wards from Reagan's portable circle, he turned the line into one of the symbols. He traced several more, breathing on the glass to clear his work and start anew. When he finished, he pulled on his clothes and went downstairs, finding Reagan sipping tea by a window, watching the sun rise over the mountains. "You're up early," Reagan noted with a smile. "You'll be a messenger yet," he said, and Arlen swelled with pride. "Today I'm going to introduce you to a friend of mine," Reagan said, "a warder. He taught me when I was your age, and he's in need of an apprentice."
"Well, couldn't I just apprentice to you?" Arlen asked hopefully. "I'll work hard."
Reagan chuckled. "I don't doubt it," he said, "but I'm a poor teacher and spend more time out of town than in. You can learn a lot from Cobb. He was a messenger before I was even born." Arlen brightened at this.
"When can I meet him?" he asked.
"The sun's up," Reagan replied. "Nothing stopping us from going right after breakfast." Soon after, Alyssa joined them in the dining room. Reagan's servants set a grand table, with bacon and ham and bread smeared with honey, eggs and potatoes and big baked apples. Arlen wolfed the meal down, eager to be out in the city. When he finished, he sat staring at Reagan as he ate. Reagan ignored him, eating with maddening slowness as Arlen fidgeted. Finally, the messenger put down his fork and wiped his mouth. "Oh, very well," he said, rising. "We can go." Arlen beamed and jumped from his seat.
"Not so fast," Alyssa called, stopping both men short.
Arlen was unprepared for the chord the word struck in him, an echo of his mother, and bit back a rush of emotion. "You're not going anywhere until the tailor comes for Arlen's measurements," she said.
"What for?" Arlen asked. "Margaret cleaned my clothes and sewed up all the rips."
"I appreciate the sentiment, love," Reagan said in Arlen's defense, "but there's hardly a rush for new clothes now that the interview with the Duke has passed."
"This isn't open to debate," Alyssa informed them, drawing herself up. "I won't have a guest in our house walking around like a pauper."
The messenger looked at the set of his wife's brow and sighed. "Let it go, Arlen," he advised quietly. "We're not going anywhere until she's satisfied." The tailor arrived soon after, a small man with nimble fingers who inspected every inch of Arlen with his knotted strings, carefully marking the information with chalk on a slate. When he was finished, he had a rather animated conversation with Lady Alyssa, bowed, and left. Alyssa glided over to Arlen, bending to face him.
Well, that wasn't so bad, was it? She asked, straightening his shirt and brushing the hair from his face. Now you can run along with Reagan to meet Master Cobb.
She caressed his cheek, her hand cool and soft, and for a moment he leaned into the familiar touch, but then pulled back short.